Hi, friends. How are we doing? Well, today, we continue our series studying the Gospel of John. And this morning, we pick up at the beginning of John 9. Before we begin, I should probably point out that today I'm trying really hard to make my voice sound cool. No, actually, I think there's been a bug that we've been passing around as a family. So not only did my wife lose her voice, but I am too, and you will probably hear me lose it during this message. It's happened at every single one of our weekend services. And so I will apologize to you in advance. Before we return to John's gospel, let's invite God to speak. Lord, some of us walked in full of faith. Others came full of doubt. Most of us came bearing both. So I pray today you'd speak to us, even if you don't answer every question. Lord, I pray today you do something better. Give us a sense of your presence with us. Whether we need this message today or tomorrow, may you surprise us with comfort and encouragement in spite of our unanswered questions, in spite of our unanswered prayer. We pray this in the name of King Jesus. Amen. This morning, I want to rewind the clock to December 2015. That Christmas was a difficult season for our family. My oldest daughter, Emma, 12 at the time, had an orthopedic surgery that put her in a wheelchair and double leg casts for a month or two. Additionally, during the week of Christmas, my dad got really sick. He developed a serious infection, but they caught it too late. When they got him to the hospital, the infection had begun attacking his organs, and he passed away just before Christmas. Well, as you can see, 2015 did not end the way we planned. Oh, but it gets so much worse. On the day after Christmas, we drag our three girls out of bed at 4:30 a.m. and race to the airport with a wheelchair, our carry-ons, and three large suitcases that are heavier than the burdens of sin and shame. Now, traveling with a child in a wheelchair has pros and cons. On the upside, we're the first to board an airplane. On the downside, we're the last to get off. The gate agents have to use a narrow wheelchair to shuttle our daughter up and down the aisle. So, first to get on, last to get off. Well, we board the plane without incident. We don't anticipate any problems until a weather delay causes a late departure from Salt Lake. Ordinarily, that wouldn't be a problem, but having a child in a wheelchair means we're the last to deplane at our layover, which causes us to miss our connecting flight in Dallas. The airline puts us on another flight. We board that plane later in the evening. We're seated in the last row. Our plane pulls away from the gate on time. Then we wait. And we wait some more until the pilot informs us that winter storms and heavy winds in Oklahoma City require them to cancel the flight. But don't worry, gate agents will help us book another flight once we exit the plane. Now remember, first to get on, last to get off. By the time we get off the plane, the line stretches from the gate in Dallas all the way back to our original departure gate in Salt Lake City. Eventually, the airline books us on a departing flight the following day, so we scramble to reserve a room at an overpriced hotel near the airport before all the rooms are taken. Well, it just so happens that evening, the entire Dallas-Fort Worth region experiences tornado warnings. Altogether, some 12 tornadoes touched down in the metropolitan area through the night, which rarely happens in December. The next morning, we pack our kids and our luggage and our wheelchair into the already overcrowded airport shuttle to catch an early flight. Meanwhile, Dallas is still being pummeled by severe thunderstorms. So we wonder about our outbound flight. As the first family on the plane, we board without issue. But I say to Suzanne, I won't believe it until we're in the air. After we're in the air, then we can rest. A few minutes later, we pull away from the gate and leave DFW on time. No problem. But then, halfway through the flight, the pilot informs us that storms in Oklahoma caused them to shut down the Oklahoma City airport. We're returning to DFW. Our flight has been canceled. Oh, but don't worry. Once we deplane, a gate agent will help us reschedule our flight. Now, in that moment, I conclude, by the time my family gets off the aircraft, my 8-year-olds will be entering the workforce. Remember, first to get on. And don't forget, I've got to speak at my dad's memorial service. So I strap bags onto my back and carry my then 5'6" daughter in her double leg cast off the airplane. When we reach the gate, there isn't a single gate agent in sight, and the line is impossibly longer than the line from the night before. I call the airline from my mobile phone. They schedule us to depart on the next available flight, 48 hours later. So, after spending 2 days spreading holiday cheer around the Dallas-Fort Worth airport, we rent an SUV and hit the road. Now, don't forget, Dallas is still being battered by severe thunderstorms. The second round hits about the time we leave town, and it is a downpour. I haven't driven in rain like that for over 20 years. Traffic along I-35 is bumper to bumper. Visibility can be measured in feet. Whole sections of the interstate are swamped by flash floods. As our car creeps along the freeway, I say to myself, I could push Emma in her wheelchair to Oklahoma City faster than this. And I would have tried, but she couldn't get her casts wet. The heavy rain continues as we cross the border into Oklahoma City, where it turns into freezing rain. Oh, good times. Hours of white-knuckle driving. We reach Oklahoma City, where we stop at the airport. You see, they told us our luggage went on a flight ahead of us. It will be waiting for us at baggage claim in Oklahoma City. Well, two of the three bags are there. We're just missing the bag with all the clothes for my wife and my preteen daughter in a wheelchair. I fill out the paperwork for the missing bag with the love of Jesus, and I drive to our hotel. When we finally drag ourselves and our bags and our twins and our daughter with the wheelchair into the room, we experience an earthquake. I'm not kidding. It was a 3.5 magnitude earthquake. I've never been in an earthquake in my life. I wake up early the next morning to go to a local coffee shop to meet with Jesus and put my soul back together. But I go into the parking lot to find that overnight, my hometown experienced an ice storm. Have any of you ever been in a Midwest ice storm? There is an 1.5-inch layer of ice on every car and every road in the metropolitan area. Question, do you think my rental car came equipped with an ice scraper? Over the next couple days, we experienced multiple earthquakes and aftershocks, including 4.2 and 4.3 magnitude earthquakes. But the high point of the trip is when I get a call from my father-in-law here back in Salt Lake. Troy, I'm so sorry. Your basement has flooded. I expected a plague of frogs by midnight. Seriously, when you go through so much so fast, you start to ask questions. Who sinned and incurred God's judgment? Was it you in the wheelchair? Since the beginning of recorded history, humankind has equated suffering with sin. If someone's life is coming undone, we surmise, then there must be a reason. I rather facetiously equate the two around Capitol all the time. When something goes wrong in our tech booth, I say to our volunteers, there must be hidden sin in your life. Repent so we can make the screens work again. The story we'll read tonight, today, takes that old myth, which equates suffering with sin, and turns it on its head, or rather, turns it right side up. The story begins in John chapter 9, verse 1. As he, meaning Jesus, went along, he saw a man blind from birth. Now, as we read this narrative today, I encourage you to experience it from the perspective of the blind man. What would it be like to be born blind? What would it be like to spend every day dependent upon the help of others? This man has never seen the clouds in the sky. Growing up, he never saw his mother's face. In the ancient world, you can imagine how hard it would be for this man to find work. Where could he go? What could he do? Now, we don't know how Jesus and his disciples knew he was born blind, but his story was probably well known in the community. People grew up with him. They watched him grow up. They're used to seeing him near the temple courts. They're used to seeing him being led around town. They've seen him so much, they've stopped seeing him. He's invisible. Maybe you've suffered so long, you feel invisible. Pain can be a lonely experience. If only you had someone to share it with you. If only you had someone who really knew what you were going through. You could be surrounded by friends and loved ones, but feel completely alone. You may live in a crowd of people, but if those people aren't undergoing the same suffering, it can feel awfully lonely. No one to talk to. No one who understands you. No one. As I think about that blind man on the roadside, his problem is not just that he can't see. It's that he's not seen. He's invisible. But John makes clear, as Jesus went along, as Jesus continued doing God's work of restoring the world, Jesus saw this man. Now, I realize as I say this, I may be making too much of a single verb, but for some of you, it will be the most important word you will read in today's passage. Jesus saw him. I don't know what frustration you're facing. I don't know what burdens you're bearing, but do you ever wonder if God's looking the other way? You ever wonder if God nodded off? Pain, problems, suffering often feel so dark. It's not just that you can't see, it's that you can't be seen. Well, I hope you leave here today believing Jesus sees you. He hasn't forgotten you. He hasn't neglected you. Even if what you're facing is not fair. We can look at the man born blind. We can easily draw a conclusion. It's not fair. It's not fair that he was born blind. It's not fair he was born blind when his peers and his siblings could see. It's not fair. But here's the axiom I want to share with you. It's true. For the man born blind, it's true for you and me. It's a simple lesson I hope sinks in. Life's not fair, but God's not finished. Life's not fair, but God's not finished. John tells us as Jesus walks by, he sees the man born blind. When the disciples see him, they ask Jesus a question. Verse 2, his disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Now that's quite a question, isn't it? And it's a leading question. The disciples ask the question. When they do so, they assume the answer is one or the other. On the one hand, the disciples surmise the parents sinned and caused their baby's blindness. On the other hand, they assume the baby sinned in the womb. Now, if you are presently a mother-to-be carrying your baby in your womb right now, this may make perfect sense to you as your little one shoves her foot into your bladder. But most of us can see the absurdity of this line of reasoning. The Bible teaches that when God created the world, it was good. It was a world free of sin and suffering. But when humankind sin affected and infected the world, bringing with it pain and problems. Well, that's the theological backstory. However, saying that is different than what the disciples said. Tim Keller summarizes it this way. Sin in general causes suffering in general. But that's very different than saying sin in particular causes suffering in particular. You can't necessarily equate individual suffering with individual sin. Sure, sometimes suffering is a direct result of someone's sin, but don't be so sure. The entire narrative of Job shows us the flaws of that assumption. In that Old Testament book that bears his name, everything snaps loose for the faithful, devout Job. And his friends come around him, and they reason with him. Job, this is terrible. Surely this is because you sinned. You've ticked God off. There's no other way to explain it. Job sits in his misery, judged and condemned by his friends who claim they have life and God figured out. But then God shows up at the end of the book to say, you're all wrong. You can't necessarily equate individual suffering with individual sin. But the disciples, who would have been very familiar with the story of Job, completely overlooked the theology of Job. Modern concepts of karma aren't so modern. We've been doing this for thousands of years. We still do it today. We get stuck in cause and effect. We think if something bad happens to me or to someone I know, it must be God's punishment for secret sin. Now, before we move on, slip back into the sandals of the blind man for a moment. He probably overhears the question of the disciples as they ask it. Those disciples who are using his suffering as an opportunity to wax philosophically about the problem of pain. How do you think he felt? Well, here's the sad part. He's probably used to it. He's probably used to being judged by the people around him who refuse to give him much grace or empathy because he's to blame for his blindness. That's not fair. I'm telling you, this is not fair. But I'll tell you what Coach Sammons taught me. See, Coach Sammons was our high school cross-country coach. Now, to be clear, I didn't run cross-country. I had Coach Sammons for Oklahoma history. But there are a couple things that I heard Coach Sammons say over and over. First, he'd say, Troy, why don't you come out and run with the boys this fall, huh? Because, Coach, I have the cardiovascular strength of a basset hound. But the other thing Coach Sammons said in response to students' complaints, it's not fair, they'd say. It's not fair, all of his students would say, when he'd do this or do that. You know what Coach would retort? He'd say, oh, that's not fair. Well, I'll tell you, life's not fair, get used to it. Every other day, well, life's not fair, get used to it. Hear me. Friends, the Bible doesn't promise that if you obey the commands and eat your vegetables, you will live a long and happy life. But this arc of John's gospel teaches a corollary to the Coach Sammons principle. Life's not fair, but God's not finished. Life's not fair, but God's not finished. What's happening to you or around you may not be fair, but God sees you and hears you. He's working when you can't see him working. He is doing stuff in the dark. In fact, as you'll see in a moment, he has come into our dark world to turn on the lights. Jesus corrects the misunderstanding of his followers in verse 3. Neither this man nor his parents sinned, said Jesus, but this happened so that the works of God might be displayed in him. Now see, we get stuck in cause and effect. We're tempted in that direction for a number of reasons, and one of them is control. We like life to be explainable. Because if we can explain it, then we can predict it. We like life to be explainable. We like life to be predictable. That's in part why we obsess over cause and effect. But here in John 9, Jesus redirects the focus of his disciples. And I think it's instructive for us today. We fixate on what happened. God wants us to keep our eyes on what happens next. Because life's not fair, but God's not finished. Without invalidating the pain of what happened, Jesus doesn't want his people to become so preoccupied with the past that we miss what he's going to do in the future. When life's not fair, he wants us to realize God's not finished, even if he looks finished. Jesus uses this opportunity to remind his disciples of the bigger picture in verse 4. As long as it is day, he says, we must do the works of him who sent me. Night is coming when no one can work. While I am in the world, I am the light of the world. In this verse, Jesus reminds them of his mission. He's the one who's sent. But they're taking part in this work too. They've got to do God's work as well while it's still daylight. Now, people in the ancient world knew this adage. You can't work in the dark. They had no artificial sources of light like we do. And when he says this, his words convey a sense of urgency. The disciples don't know why, though I bet they put it together a little later. See, when Jesus speaks of the night that is coming, he's referring to the cross, which, by the way, was the most unfair moment in human history. Think about it. The most unfair thing that happened in the history of the world was when the Son of God was unjustly punished for our sin. And we'll see this later in John's gospel when his faithful followers see him crucified. They can't make heads or tails of it. They don't see God working on the cross. They see life's unfairness. Now, the fact of the matter is, they couldn't be more wrong. God was actually doing his best work on the cross when it looked like he wasn't even present. This subtle allusion to the cross is a not-so-subtle reminder. Life's not fair, but God's not finished. My friend, you could take that to the bank. Life's not fair, but God's not finished. Jesus says, I am the light of the world. And what he's about to do is a sign. Now, John uses the word sign in his gospel to describe the miracles of Jesus. He does so to emphasize that Jesus' actions point to a work of God beyond the signs themselves. In sum, the sign is a symbol of something greater. It's foreshadowing. It's a hint of things to come. Verse 6, after saying this, he spit on the ground, made some mud with saliva, and put it on the man's eyes. Ancient Near East scholars debate why Jesus did what he did. Some point to the ancient myths that saliva had healing power. Others think his work points back to the creation account in Genesis chapter 2, where God made man from dirt. My hunch is, Jesus' words and actions are so rich in meaning, we best not limit them to a single interpretation. We were talking about this passage together this week, and my friend Tara made a simple but profound observation. She said, you know, when Jesus is making mud, he's making a mess. Hear me. God's great works of healing and restoration often look a little messy at first. Is your healing process looking a bit messy right now? Often I found God is doing his best work of new creation when it looks like he's just making a mess. Here's another observation from the passage. Did you notice? The blind man hasn't said a word. Not a word. Often in the Gospels, we find people who need healing clamoring for Jesus' attention. Not here. Here, we find a guy minding his own business when Jesus starts rubbing mud on his face. You know what that sounds like to me? You might have just thought, assault. No, you know what that sounds like to me? Grace. How God, in his grace, interrupts our darkness with his light. Now, there's clearly deep spiritual meaning in the experience of the blind man with Jesus. We'll say a lot more about that next week. But for now, let me ask you, does it feel like you've been minding your own business, but Jesus has come along and started rubbing mud in your eyes? If you look at it from the wrong angle, you might think he's being mean. But what if he's restoring sight to the blind? What if he's turning on the light? Verse 7, go, he told him. Wash in the pool of Siloam. This word means sent. Jesus sends the man to wash off the mud. He sends him to a particular pool located nearby. Now, it is from this pool they drew water for the Feast of Tabernacles. And the pool's position near the temple indicates it was used for ritual bathing to cleanse from impurity before entering God's presence and the temple. Now, again, the passage is laden with symbolism, which we'll see next week. But for now, just note, the guy still doesn't say a word. He doesn't profess faith in Jesus. He simply does what Jesus says to do and waits to see what happens next. Now, I wonder if that is instructive to anyone listening right now. You're wondering if you could take Jesus at his word. You're wondering if you can trust Jesus with your life. Maybe this is your first step of faith, simply doing what Jesus says and watch what happens next. Verse 7. So the man went and washed and came home seeing. This may be one of the most understated passages in John's gospel. The man born blind sees. What would that have been like? What did he say? What did he feel? John doesn't tell us. I imagine the guy looking up at the sky. Oh, that's blue. You guys have been talking about blue. I didn't know what blue was. That's blue. I get it. What would this moment have been like? What does this miracle mean? And why did John include it in his gospel? Does John want us to get the message that God will always heal? I don't think so. But I do think John wants us to see when life's not fair, God's not finished. See, we have a God who willingly enjoy steps into the muck and mire of our world, of our lives, to redeem, to heal, to restore. N.T. Wright says it this way, the chaos and misery of this present world is, it seems, the raw material out of which the loving, wise, and just God is making his new creation. Right in the middle of your mess. I'm telling you, right in the middle of your mess. How might God want to use your suffering to show the world who he is? Oh, I hope it's through restoration. I hope it's through healing. I hope he redeems you and relieves you quick, right now. I pray you can get past your suffering as soon as possible. But I know from reading the scripture, that's not always how God works. The Apostle Paul, who arguably had it in with God, you know, he had an inside track. And he's sitting here working for God and suffering for God, and he prays to God, Lord, take this from me. And he calls it his thorn in the flesh. We don't know what it is. It's in 2 Corinthians 12 that he prays this. And it's this thorn in his flesh. It's some kind of physical ailment, we think, that he thought was really getting in the way of his life and ministry. God, I could do so much more. I can move further, faster. If you just take this from me, and he prayed and prayed and prayed. And God never responded until he did. And you know what he said? No. That's what God said. God said no, but he said, here's what I'm going to do, Paul. I'm going to show the world my strength through your weakness. Well, that's interesting. I gotta wonder, how might your suffering show the world who who he is. Now see, when you think like that, you gotta recognize there's more going on. When you see your suffering, and I'm talking everything from a bad year to a bad decade. When you see your suffering, you gotta recognize there's more going on. Who knows how God might use you? Who knows how God might reveal himself to the world? Think about this bloke. He's been blind all his life on a random roadside in Jerusalem, encounters Jesus, his life is changed, and here we are some 2,000 years later talking about him in a message on the other side of the world. By the way, back then, that guy had no idea there was another side of the world. But 2,000 years later, his story is still impacting the world for good, for God. How might he use your story? There's a passage we talk about a lot as followers of Jesus, and rightly so. It's Romans chapter 8, verse 28. It says, "We know that in all things, God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose." In all things, God works for the good. Paul writes about a God who's always working, sometimes behind the scenes, sometimes completely unseen, but always working to bring about his good purposes for his people. In all things, God works for the good. Now, that's different than saying everything is good, because clearly not everything is good. However, circumstances, whether good or bad, whether perfect or painful, every circumstance can be redeemed by God for good. Think for a moment about the darkest season of your life. It may have been 20 years ago. It may have been 2 days ago. Maybe it was a time when you sunk to the depths of depression. Maybe it was a period in which your soul was poisoned by a toxic relationship. Maybe it was a moment in which you knew you blew it big and you hurt a lot of people and you hurt them badly. Today, I'm praying that God will help you to see that moment, that season, that tragedy can be redeemed by God for good. Maybe you're in that season right now. And maybe you're shaking your fist in protest because God isn't doing what you think he should be doing. Is there an injustice in your life you think God should correct? Is there a problem you face you think God should fix? Maybe it's something that's simply not fair. Oh, I'm here to tell you today, life's not fair, but God's not finished. Life's not fair, but God's not finished. In all things, he works for the good. Now, maybe you push back when you hear me speak those words. And you say, easy for you to say. Troy, you don't know what I've been through. You don't know what I faced. That's easy for you to say. And I'll say to you, you're right. You're right. Honestly, I've lived a charmed life. I grew up in a middle-class existence in middle America, found faith at an early age. And I'll tell you, here was the deal breaker. It changed everything. At a very young age, I came to know him. And when I say that, I mean, I came to trust him with everything in me. And I realized at my young age, this is the best way to live life. So I put all my chips on God. It's terrible to use a gambling analogy for a kid, but I put all my eggs in his basket, okay? And I said, I can trust him. And I did. And I never looked back. I never stopped trusting. Now hear me, some days are better than others. I still make loads of mistakes. I think I made 89 mistakes last week. But God and his grace comes around me and he keeps me and he protects me, often from myself, and he doesn't let me screw it up past the point of his redemption. Oh my word, was that the best move I ever made? And here's the truth. I was lucky. Look, I don't believe in luck. So a more theologically accurate word might be blessed. But I'm not talking to you who need a theologically accurate word. I was lucky and I know it. And I found him at an early age. And he's proven himself to me in such a real way, in such a complete way, that it is so easy for me to say life's not fair, but God's not finished. That being said, doesn't mean I'm wrong. And it's just my story. But I want you to hear it. You can trust him. All the unfair things that you've experienced. Oh, as hard as it is to believe, he's not finished. Maybe this weekend you are left reeling because God's plan is not yet clear. How will the answers arrive? Oh, where will the money come from? When will the hurting stop? The when, where, what, and how may be left unanswered. But my friends, the who most certainly isn't. God is up to something. Just don't be surprised if he does something you're not expecting. See, if your mind's made up about what God should do, you might miss what he's actually doing. He's not finished. Let's pray. Lord, first I pray for my friend listening to this message who is facing an unfairness that feels unbearable. Pain is so great. Maybe it's the darkness of depression. Maybe it's the despair of divorce. Maybe it's the wounds of abuse that never seem to heal. Maybe it's the grief of losing a loved one. They lost way too soon. Lord, in this moment, I pray for that guy or gal that they would sense you taking them by the hand and hear you say, "You're right, this isn't fair." May they feel your presence and the healing love that comes with your presence. And may they hear you whisper those wonderful words, "But I'm not finished." I pray for the young person who's listening to this message and they're in early stage of life, just trying to figure out life and love and friendship and faith. Oh God, would you show them the utter logic, the ridiculous opportunity they have to put their hope and trust in you? Not just for the life after this life, I'm talking about for this life. That your way is the better way. Your way to live is the better way to live. And they can live this life with faith and hope. It changes everything. They can participate in what you are doing in the world, bringing heaven on earth, bringing up there, down here. It's the better way to live. I pray they open their eyes to see that in the midst of all of their problems and their pain and their drama, their despair. May they put their hope in you, even at this young age. I pray for them. The individual here who's been around the block a time or two, a little further down the field, maybe toward the end of their life. And they walked in believing the myth, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. God, I pray you teach him a trick. And that trick is trust. May they put their trust in you. And in a way that has never made sense before now, but truly entrust their life to your keeping. Not just their future, but their present. And not just their present, but their past. May they trust your grace. May they trust your truth. May what they experience today change everything. Everything. Finally, I want to pray for the person who's not a person of faith yet. And they're here with mixed feelings because what they've experienced lately, the best way to describe it is it's like a guy minding his own business and you come along and rub mud in his eye. And it does not feel delightful. It is not welcomed. I didn't ask for this. But God, show them that may be the exact thing they need right now, in this moment, in real time. It may feel mean, but it's actually the most wonderful, loving, gracious thing you could do. You have stopped everything to interrupt their darkness with your light. I pray they see it. I pray they see you, and I pray they trust you. May this day change everything for them too. May they find a faith that helps them to put this to words today. Tonight, before their head hits the pillow, I pray they have an authentic, genuine, and real conversation with you. Not a forced one, not a religious one. One that's just between you and them. And they don't need to worry, because while they may not have known you their whole life, you have known them. Give them the faith. Give them the faith to put their trust in you. I pray it in the wonderful and the strong name of the King who's come and is coming. Amen. How about some homework? I give you some homework. I got two assignments for you today. And I'm telling you, before they are displayed on the screen, it ain't Shakespeare, okay? Paul and I were talking about what homework should we give them for the week, and we bounced some ideas off of them. Now, when I reference Paul, I should make clear the drivel that you're about to see on this screen is utterly my own doing. Here's the first assignment. You ready for this one? Hang around Jesus. Oh, I mean, that's deep, right? Well, let me tell you what I mean. Let me tell you specifically who I'm talking to. I'm talking to those of you who don't know him yet. Think about it like this. The blind bloke in John 9. Man, that dude was just in the right place at the right time, wasn't he? What I'm telling you to do is get yourself in the right place at the right time. Take a little ownership of this. Be intentional about it. And I know I'm using a metaphor here. Hang around Jesus. How do you do that? Well, here's one way. Okay, ready? Brace yourself. Come to church. Oh, wow. From a pastor, of all things. But no, seriously. Make it a priority. Make it a habit. Come to church. Now, when I say that, this is not a legalistic decree. You need to come to church. But you need to come to church. And when I say that, I don't mean so you can get your Jesus buck checked and, you know, you'll earn your way to heaven. Oh, my word, no. I'm saying there's something powerful about being in a community of people who are learning together how to do life from Jesus. Something happens. And when you're around people who are learning together like this, oh, you are hanging around Jesus. Jesus told us himself. He said, where two or three are gathered together in my name, yeah, I'm there too. Come to church. Join a small group. We talk about small groups all the time. We've got small groups. We've got community groups. We've got all kinds of things that you can dive deeper into and begin to develop spiritual friendships with people. I know we talk about it all the time. I promise you, I'm going to keep talking about it because it's so important. We've found spiritual friendships a deal breaker. You want to thrive in the spiritual life, you have got to develop spiritual friendships. If you're interested, fill out a connection card. Tell us you're interested in a small group or getting connected. We want to get you connected. Drop it in the offering bucket. Send us an email, info@capitalchurch.com. We'll get you connected, okay? Here's another way to hang around Jesus. Read the Bible. Read the Bible. Now, I know the Bible's hard to understand. And hear me, the moment you start reading it, there will be loads of things you won't understand. Really. You'll be all right. But there's something about that book. Yeah, I know it was written for an ancient time and an ancient audience, but there is a reason humankind has clung to it for thousands of years, because there's something about it that God reveals himself to it. And we've seen that in countless cultures over the centuries. God reveals himself through the book in a unique way. I know he speaks in lots of different ways, but man, does he speak through the Bible. That's why I teach from it every week. So I'm going to challenge you to read the Bible. Maybe start in the New Testament. Start in the Gospel of Matthew. It's the first book of the New Testament. Or Mark or Luke or John, this fourth book that we're studying. And just begin to acquaint yourself with the teaching and the life of Jesus. Hang around him. See what happens. Before I get to the second assignment, let me set it up a little. You know, when I think about that passage in Romans 8, and I think about how God works in all things for the good of those who love him, you know, I kind of like to try to speculate. What is God doing? And so I extrapolate ideas. You know, when I'm in suffering and I don't understand what's going on, I start to think, I'm like, well, maybe God's doing this or maybe God's doing that. And I come up with all these ideas of what God might be doing. That's a good thing. It's fine. It helps me to, I'm trying to increase my God awareness. Oh, maybe he's going to be over here or maybe he's going to do that. Great, great, great. This is all great. However, brace yourself for the unexpected. Brace yourself for the unexpected because he may do something you're not ready for. You can trust him. Life's not fair, but he's not finished. Don't assume you're going to see what he's doing when he's doing it. You may not figure it out until later. Heck, you may not figure it out until much later. But I'm telling you, you can trust him. Several weeks ago, we're working through a series with a really dumb title. Remember the series called SCO? Well, in the middle of this series, I recommended a book to you. And the book's title is Streams in the Desert by L.B. Kalman. Now, this is a daily devotional, just a quick something that you can read that'll get you connected to God. She references some passages from the Bible and gets you to think. And it's particularly written for people in the context of suffering, which, by the way, is most of us. Well, here's what happened. When I recommended that book that week, and I just had this sense that you all would take to this book. So we bought double what we'd ordinarily buy to stock our bookstore, okay? Well, I'm telling you, I couldn't even get to the 11 o'clock service. All of the books were sold out before the 11. So we stocked more. And guess what? People kept buying them. And I've heard from so many of you who are working through this simple devotional and how you're finding God through it. So I'm going to recommend it again. You want the good news or the bad news? Well, it's the same news. oh my word, I think they bought them all again. I'm serious, I think we might have one or two copies back there, and as soon as I say that, somebody's gonna just run to the back and get it. And you have no idea how many dozens and dozens of these things we've flown through, okay? But people keep buying them. And guess what? We will keep buying them, and we'll stock more this week. But order one for yourself. You can drop ship it on Amazon or wherever you'd like. If you like digital books, you can download it on a Kindle app or wherever you get books. It's available. And what I'm going to tell you is it's a simple way to connect yourself to God. I am so sorry. I really thought I overbought the books, and they were going to say to me, oh my word, Troy, really? Why'd you buy that many? That's what I expected everyone to say. Clearly, I was wrong. So thank you for your grace. We'll get more next week. Here's a verse for the week, Romans 8:28. The image you see on the screen along with the following graphic will be available for you to download from our website, so be watching for them. Please stand with me. If you came with a need, there will be some people waiting here at the front to pray for you, so make your way up and invite them to do so. And again, I want to thank you for your grace in listening to this sermon with this voice. How many of you are thinking, yeah, but Troy, that is a sexy voice. Even though pastors shouldn't say sexy. Here's my prayer for all of you. When life's not fair, when life's not fair, may you find the faith to recognize God's not finished with your story. Thanks for coming. Grace and peace.